latest world news headlines.
Gunmen storm the Libyan parliament and stop the vote on a new prime minister. And the UN eases diamond and arms restrictions on the Ivory Coast. I'm Frances Alonzo reporting from Washington. Gunmen stormed Libya's parliament, firing shots and causing lawmakers to suspend a vote for the country's new prime minister. Libyan officials say the armed men broke into the building housing Libya's General National Congress in Tripoli today and fired shots in the air. Reuters news agency reports several people were injured in the shooting. It quotes a parliamentarian spokesman as saying that the gunmen were linked to one of the defeated candidates for prime minister. The vote was to replace Abdullah Al-Thani, who resigned earlier this month. The interrupted second round of voting was between two other candidates. The UN Security Council has lifted a ban on diamond exports from Ivory Coast. It also moved to ease an arms embargo in the West African nation. The council today adopted a resolution lifting the diamond embargo that was put in place in 2005 during the country's civil war. The arms embargo was lifted so Ivorian security forces can acquire small caliber weapons. The Ivory Coast UN ambassador hailed the vote. He said the UN recognizes his country has fully satisfied minimum conditions of the Kimberley process. That's the system to ensure so-called conflict diamonds do not enter world markets. U.S. President Barack Obama took another swipe at China's foreign policy today as he wrapped up a week-long four-nation tour of Asia. Speaking to U.S. and Philippine troops before departing Manila, President Obama repeated his administration's long-held stances on China's maritime disputes.
Deepening our alliance is part of our broader vision for the Asia-Pacific. We believe that nations and peoples have the right to live in security and peace and have their sovereignty and territorial integrity respected. We believe that international law must be upheld, that freedom of navigation must be preserved, and commerce must not be impeded. We believe that disputes must be resolved peacefully and not by intimidation or force.
The comments, which did not mention China by name, come a day after Washington and Manila signed a new defense deal. At least 50 people have been killed in a bomb and mortar attacks in two Syrian cities. In the city of Homs, two car bombs exploded in a mainly Alawite neighborhood, killing 36 people. An official said today's bombing also wounded more than 85. Meanwhile, in Damascus, mortar shells killed at least 14 people and injured more than 85 others. Syria's government blamed the Damascus attack on terrorists, a term it uses for rebels fighting to oust President Bashar al-Assad. Meanwhile, 35 experts on international law and humanitarian issues have signed an open letter calling on the United Nations to do more to deliver aid to millions of people in Syria who desperately need it. VOA's Al Pessin reports.
The open letter published in European newspapers says the United Nations is too concerned about violating Syria's sovereignty and should do more to force the Damascus government to allow humanitarian aid into the country. The experts say the legal commitment to Syria's sovereignty is outweighed by an international doctrine called the responsibility to protect. The concept is that if states do not protect their citizens from mass killing and other crimes against humanity, the international community has a responsibility to do so. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Two bomb blasts in Iraq have killed at least 15 people a day before the country holds its first general elections since U.S. troops withdrew in 2011. Today's attacks took place at a market in the town of Al-Sadiyah, which is about 140 kilometers northeast of Baghdad. On Monday, insurgents targeting polling stations and political gatherings killed at least 50 people in the Iraqi capital and areas north of the city. No one claimed responsibility for the attacks, but Sunni militants have been accused of similar acts and attempts to derail the political process. North Korea has begun live-fire artillery exercises near its disputed western sea boundary with South Korea. Seoul's defense ministry spokesperson said today that it was informed by Pyongyang of those planned drills. South Korean military officials said the North fired 50 rounds of artillery and that none landed in South Korean territory. The North held similar drills last month. You can read more details on this and more 24 hours a day at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonzo, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is racing to provide essential supplies for hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese displaced by war before rains make roads impassable.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Secretary of State John Kerry is on his way to visit four African countries, Ethiopia, South Sudan, DRC, and Angola. And South Africa's ruling party postpones a parliamentary inquiry into corruption allegations against President Jacob Zuma.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Secretary of State John Kerry is on his way to four African countries, Ethiopia, South Sudan, DRC, and Angola. Before leaving, Kerry spoke to VOA Africa 54 host Vincent McCorry about some of the ongoing hotspots on the continent. He says the Obama administration is evaluating the situation in South Sudan before deciding whether to impose targeted sanctions. He says the administration is waiting to see if negotiations in Addis Ababa and diplomacy have any effect in restoring peace.
I look forward to my conversations when I'm in Addis Ababa and meeting with the leadership there, and I look forward to continuing to work with a number of different parties to see if we can leverage a better outcome. As you know, I appointed a special envoy with President Obama, Don Booth, the ambassador who was in Ethiopia. He's been deeply engaged on the ground. I personally was very, very engaged during the course of the Christmas period this year when the violence broke out. I was almost every day on the telephone with President Kiir, with former Vice President Riek Machar, trying to find a way forward. I talked to the leaders of Uganda, of Ethiopia, elsewhere. And we're going to continue to push. But it may be that sanctions are one of the things that have to take impact. We're evaluating that now.
The Secretary of State expressed his disappointment in the situation in South Sudan, the world's newest country.
The tragedy of this cannot be overstated. Many nations spent a long time and a lot of energy to help South Sudan emerge as a nation. This was a moment of great hope, and to see it tugged downwards by personal ambitions and personal animosities is really in many ways a betrayal of the trust of the people in their leaders. And I think all of the people involved in governance and civil society need to take stock of very fundamental choices that need to be made in order to reverse this course.
Kerry says the international community can only do so much. It's up to the South Sudanese leaders to end the fighting.
Well, they have to embrace it for themselves. I mean, you know the old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You have to get leaders who are prepared to drink. I mean, I see this not just there, but all over the world. I mean, we're wrestling with Palestinians and Israelis today, and wrestling with Ukraine and Russia and President Putin. People have to make good decisions. Leaders have to make decisions that lead. And if you allow things to get into a personal downward spiral, it becomes very difficult. And it's a betrayal of the interests of people broadly. So the leaders need to step up here and open up to creating a civil society, open up to government reforms, open up to dialogue, open up to inclusivity. All those kinds of things need to happen, and open up to compromise.
Secretary Kerry says the U.S. is also concerned about the violence in northern Nigeria, where the militant group Boko Haram is blamed for many civilian deaths.
We're working very closely with our allies and with our partners and friends. We've been providing assistance. We've been providing direct lift, aircraft, other things to help people go in to take on the Boko Haram. We've been providing support directly to the government. It's, again, You're right. It's very, very complicated. There's been violence, and the government needs to be stronger, and we're working to help strengthen it. Everybody understands it's not just in Nigeria. It's in Mali. It's in Tunisia. It's in Libya still. You're seeing these tensions spread throughout the Maghreb and the Sahel. And we are doing everything possible. We've augmented our presence. We have increased our assistance. And we will continue to do so and to work with our friends, the French and others, in an effort to try to make a difference.
As for Somalia, Kerry says the U.S. continues to provide support to the government and African forces battling the militant group Al-Shabaab.
We've made some progress. We think the leaders in Somalia have helped significantly to try to create a beachhead of governance, and they've made some progress. But Al-Shabaab and others have reached not just there, into Kenya, into other parts of the East, and this is a continued struggle. This is not going to be easy. But I'm convinced the vast majority of the populations, and I think the leaders, want to move in the right direction, and it just takes additional help.
That's Secretary of State John Kerry. He spoke with Africa 54 host Vincent McCorry. Kerry left today to visit Ethiopia, South Sudan, DRC, and Angola. You can watch the entire interview with John Kerry on VOA's TV program Africa 54, which airs at 16:30 UTC.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is racing to provide essential supplies for hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese displaced by war before the rains make roads impassable. The UNHCR says many of these people have fled their homes with little or no personal belongings. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Nearly 1 million South Sudanese have become internally displaced since fighting between government and opposition forces broke out 4 months ago. They are spread across about 175 makeshift and organized sites, with the largest number in Upper Nile State. UNHCR spokeswoman Fatoumata Lejeune-Kaba describes conditions in most of these sites as appalling. She says they lack water and sanitation. She blames the terrible conditions on underfunding and lack of security.
It's not everywhere that we can access all the time. The lines of fighting move constantly. The displaced themselves move constantly. So even if they receive assistance in one place and they are forced again to flee because of new fighting, they find themselves with nothing. It's overcrowded for most of them, including, of course, at the UN bases. The sites are not proper at all.
Lejeune-Kaba says the UNHCR is airlifting more relief supplies Tuesday from Dubai to the capital, Juba, for 100,000 displaced people. She says the blankets, sleeping mats, water buckets, and other relief items will be distributed mainly in Unity, Upper Nile, and Jonglei states. The UNHCR also is assisting thousands of South Sudanese civilians who have fled to Sudan in search of asylum. Lejeune-Kaba tells VOA the agency's priority is to relocate 23,000 South Sudanese in White Nile State away from where they presently are staying.
We've had visits there to the relocation areas, and it seems like people will be willing to go. It's important because very soon we won't be able to access the Kilo 10 site. So most likely people will move and relocate.
Lejeune-Kaba says it already is raining in White Nile State, but the heaviest rains usually begin in May. Meanwhile, the UNHCR and its partners also are providing aid to tens of thousands of South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia. She says aid agencies are expanding accommodation for nearly 100,000 refugees in the Gambela region in the west of the country. She says land is being cleared for a fifth camp near Kule for up to 30,000 people. She says the camp is expected to open early next month. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, the International Organization for Migration, IOM, condemns yesterday's attack on a convoy in Desiku in the Central African Republic that left two people dead and seven injured. The 18-truck convoy was carrying over 1,000 civilians from Bangui's PK-12 neighborhood to safer areas in the northeast of the country. The IOM is providing logistical support for the UN operation to urgently relocate Muslims and ethnic minorities who are trapped in PK-12. Giuseppe Laprete is the chief of mission for IOM in Bangui. He spoke with me about the latest convoy attack.
Well, the convoy left Bangui on Sunday with 1,300 people. They were all stranded, trapped in PK-12 since December. Basically, they were trying to leave Bangui when everything happened, and they couldn't. They've been surrounded by the anti-Balaka, and basically they were trapped for 4 months. So on Sunday, finally, we managed to organize this convoy. They are not from Bangui originally. These are Poles, nomads, Arabophones, so they were trying to go back to their own areas. And this is where they are going now. It's a long trip from Bangui. It's 3 days, so the convoy was attacked yesterday when it was between Sibut and the Dekoa halfway. We don't have all the details of the attack because the convoy hasn't arrived yet. They will be in Cabo in a couple of hours. This is the latest news we have. And when the convoy will arrive, we will make the point of the situation with MISCA, also African forces that are escorting the convoy.
Have the two people been identified that were killed?
Yes, they've been identified. We don't have the name so far, but it was a woman, 27 years old, and a man, 58, I think, is a detail. Well, MISCA managed to respond to the attack, so they could continue, and they stopped later on when they were in a safer area. The problem is that there is no safe area right now in Central African Republic, so they're moving into areas controlled alternatively by anti-Balaka and then Seleka, so they're going through very difficult areas. The road is not good, so all these difficulties are making the journey, let's say, very difficult.
Do you all have any more convoys scheduled?
No more convoys scheduled. I mean, this is not a massive evacuation from Bangui. PK-12 was a very distinct situation that we were trying to solve since December. As I said, these people are not from Bangui, not from PK-12. The actual people from PK-12 are in the spontaneous site here in Bangui, and they will most probably they will go back to PK-12 following days or weeks. So this was a very specific situation. There is another group, the community, the Muslim community is still present in Bangui. They are in PK-5 in the 3rd district around the central mosque and inside of the central mosque. There is no plan to evacuate them or to relocate them. We are working on social cohesion. We want them to stay, and they told us, they told also the government, that if security is guaranteed, they don't want to go. They don't want to stay in Bangui, but they want to be free to move. They want to be free to cross the road without being attacked by the anti-Balaka groups. They want to go to the market, and they want to have a normal life here as it was before December.
So there are still Muslims that are there locally in the neighborhoods. However, they are going to be staying there. As you mentioned, the safety is a consideration. So what type of security measures are being put into place to keep them safe?
The EU force, for example, is being deployed now and will continue in April and May. We asked for extra attention to MISCA and Sangaris, especially in the 3rd district of Bangui, which is the area where still there is a mixed population of Christian and Muslims. There will be the peacekeeping mission that will be deployed in September. So security is the main challenge. If we manage to work on security, not only the Muslims will stay, but also the displaced persons that are now in the 40-plus camps in Bangui, they will return to their neighborhood, to their areas, and they will resume their activities and restart their life.
Giuseppe Laprete is the chief of mission for IOM in Bangui. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 20 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is on his way to visiting four African countries. The UN Refugee Agency is racing to provide essential supplies for hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese displaced by war. And South Africa's ruling party has postponed a parliamentary inquiry into corruption allegations against President Jacob Zuma. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Human Rights Commissioner Navi Pillay today called the death sentences of over 680 Egyptians outrageous. Pillay also called the verdict shocking and said it is high time that Egypt started taking human rights seriously. Her statement was released following a 10-minute hearing yesterday by a judge in the Egyptian city of Menya. The defendants were charged in the death of a policeman last August during a demonstration. Supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi had protested against his arrest. The trials are part of a major government crackdown on the Mr. Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood.
The first case of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, has been discovered in Egypt. Health authorities say the infection was found in a man who recently returned from working in Saudi Arabia. The patient was admitted to a hospital in East Cairo. MERS is caused by the coronavirus. The World Health Organization reports that since September 2012, there have been 254 laboratory-confirmed cases of the infection, including 93 deaths. Symptoms of MERS can include severe respiratory illness, fever, cough, shortness of breath, pneumonia, kidney failure, stomach and intestinal diseases, and diarrhea. The virus has been detected specifically among camels, but experts do not know how it is transmitted.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Gunmen stormed Libya's parliament today, firing shots and causing lawmakers to suspend a vote for the country's new prime minister. The parliament was choosing a replacement for Abdullah Al-Thani, who resigned earlier this month. Libyan officials say the armed men broke into the building housing Libya's General National Congress in Tripoli. There are reports that several people were injured.
And two Libyan soldiers were killed today when a suicide bomber's car blew up at the front gate of a barracks in Benghazi. Two others were wounded in the attack on the special force camp. Libyan armed forces have been battling Ansar al-Sharia fighters and other hardline militants since the 2011 fall of Muammar Gaddafi. In other news on Libya, the government is negotiating with the kidnappers of the Jordanian ambassador who was abducted 2 weeks ago in the eastern part of the country. As part of the proposal deal, Jordan would return a Libyan who's serving a life sentence in Amman. He was convicted of trying to blow up the international airport in Amman. He would serve the remainder of his life sentence in a Libyan prison. Most foreign diplomats have left the Benghazi area, where U.S. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other Americans were killed in 2012.
South Africa's ruling party has postponed a parliamentary inquiry into corruption allegations against President Jacob Zuma. The ANC says the committee does not have time to consider the matter before elections that are less than 10 days away. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Just 6 weeks after South Africa's top anti-corruption official issued a 400-page report detailing how Mr. Zuma used $23 million of public funds to make renovations to his private home, an investigative committee in Parliament, which met only twice, dropped its inquiry. The official reason, not enough time before elections. Cyril Ramaphosa is Mr. Zuma's deputy in the ruling ANC party and will be second in command of the nation if the ANC triumphs in the May 7th elections, as it is expected to. Ramaphosa dismisses opposition allegations that this is a political dodge.
And so that matter of the Nkandla report is going to be handled clearly in the next parliament. And that in many ways is a practical, very practical decision, because right now the committee having been set up, it would practically not be able to even complete the process of dealing with that report, because it is a huge report, and indeed there's still other further things that need to be done. If you look at the terms of reference that were crafted by the Speaker. So we are satisfied that this matter is going to be handled as we move on.
Opponents of the ANC have criticized its record on unemployment, corruption, and service delivery to poor South Africans. And many analysts expect the party's margin of victory in next week's elections to be smaller than normal. But the party of the late Nelson Mandela appears to retain a hold on most South African voters. Ramaphosa, a former union activist turned millionaire businessman, displaced Mr. Zuma's current deputy at the ANC's national conference in 2012. That move puts Ramaphosa on a direct path to be the ANC's presidential candidate if Mr. Zuma finishes a possible second term in 2019, or to inherit the presidential mantle if Mr. Zuma does not finish that term. On Tuesday, Ramaphosa made light of his aspirations.
My great ambition is to be president of the golf club where I play golf. One, that is my greatest dream. I'd like to be president of that. And I'd also like to be president of my fishing club. That is the sum total of my ambitions.
But one wonders, if the ANC remains in power, will he settle for president of South Africa? Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today, because they gave me a lot of support morally.
And AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Music Time in Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me. I'm Heather Maxwell for Music Time in Africa. Every Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 2000, and 2100 UTC.
The Voice of America, VOA.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is on his way to visit four African countries, Ethiopia, South Sudan, DRC, and Angola. The U.N. Refugee Agency races to provide essential supplies for hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese displaced by war. And South Africa's ruling party postpones a parliamentary inquiry into corruption allegations against President Jacob Zuma. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda. And in our feature segment, according to the World Bank, Africa is experiencing economic growth but must find jobs for 11 million people. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheyas Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Kim.
Happy Tuesday to you too, Sunny. And I understand you're beginning in the Egyptian capital today.
Kim, let's kick off in Cairo. That's where the Confederation of African Football, CAF, held the draw Tuesday for the mini-league phase of its two top club competitions, the Champions League and the Confederation Cup. First, the Champions League, Africa's richest club competition. Group A has two clubs from the Democratic Republic of Congo, while Group B has two teams from Tunisia. In Group A, Vita and TP Mazembe from the DRC are joined by Al Hilal of Sudan and five-time champion Zamalek of Egypt. Meanwhile, Group B features four North African clubs. In addition to Esperance and CS Sfaxien from Tunisia, we have Al Ahly Benghazi of Libya and Entente Setif of Algeria. The Champions League mini-league matches will begin the weekend of May 16th, 17th, and 18th, and wrap up the weekend of August 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. Group winners and runners-up will advance to the semifinals. Now let's take a look at the Confederation Cup draw. Al Ahly of Egypt, the 2013 Champions League winner, is drawn in Group B with Etoile Sahel of Tunisia, Siwe San Pedro of Ivory Coast, and Nkana FC of Zambia. Group A has AC Leopards of Congo Brazzaville, ASEC Mimosas of Ivory Coast, AS Real Bamako of Mali, and Cotton Sport of Cameroon. The Confederation Cup mini-league matches will also begin the weekend of May 16th, 17th, and 18th, and wrap up the weekend of August 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. Once again, group winners and runners-up go through to the semifinals. Now, keep in mind, VOA football fans, the Confederation Cup is the only major African trophy that Al Ahly of Egypt, winner of a record 8 CAF Champions League titles, has not lifted in its illustrious history. I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is www.facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, www.facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Soccerlicious greetings from Washington, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, Africa's big tournament in 2015 will take place in Morocco, the Africa Cup of Nations, and the African Football Confederation, CAF, recently held some meetings to discuss the tournament. How about some details, David, beginning with the first round draw?
Right, Sunny. Well, it took a long time for this draw to take place. 414 days, to be precise, since it was originally due to be held in Morocco. Then it was due to be held in South Africa. And finally, at the weekend in Cairo, the big moment arrived. And let's go through that first round draw. Liberia against Lesotho, Kenya against Comores, Madagascar against Uganda, Mauritania against Equatorial Guinea, Namibia faced Congo-Brazzaville, Libya up against Rwanda, Burundi against Botswana, Central African Republic against Guinea-Bissau, Swaziland against Sierra Leone, Gambia against Seychelles, Sao Tome e Principe against Benin, Malawi against Chad, Tanzania against Zimbabwe, and Mozambique against South Sudan. And the first leg, Sunny, May 16, 17, and 18, and the return match is May 30, 31, and June 1st. So each country's got an option. They can choose to play on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday.
Based on those pairings, David, how does the second round draw shape up for Morocco 2015?
Right, Sunny. We will then have Liberia or Lesotho against Kenya or Comores. And I'll preempt you, Sunny, by making some predictions. I know you like to hang me out to dry in the hot African sun. Liberia, Lesotho, Kenya or Comores. I'm going with the Harambee Stars of Kenya. I think it's going to be, Sunny, Liberia against Kenya. And, you know, Kenya long overdue an appearance at the African Nations Cup. So let's hope that they make the group stage this time. I think football in East Africa needs a big boost. We need to see an East African presence at the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. So I'll give a tentative nod there to Kenya. Then we got Madagascar or Uganda against Mauritania or Equatorial Guinea. Now, on a previous Sunny Side of Sport, I singled out Mauritania as a potential team to watch. I think they've got the beating of the Equatorial Guineans, but I'm not sure they've got the beating of Uganda. I think Uganda can beat both Madagascar and then probably Mauritania. So I'm going for another East African team, Uganda, to make the group stage. Then what I consider, Sunny, to be the real big one, it's Namibia or Congo-Brazzaville versus Libya or Rwanda. Now, among the teams that didn't make it automatically to the group stage, I singled out Libya, the winners of the 2014 African Nations Championship, and Congo-Brazzaville, always a combative side, as two of the strongest among the sides that had to go through this preliminary knockout qualifying phase. And now the, I won't call it luck of the draw, it's probably more the ill luck of the draw, probably going to pit the Congolese against the Libyans. I'll go with the Libyans, but I think it could be really close. The Congolese, the Red Devils from Central Africa, great cup fighters. Then we've got Burundi or Botswana against Central African Republic or Guinea-Bissau. Now, sad to say, Sunny, the problems in the Central African Republic continue, and at this stage, I think there's very little chance that they're going to be able to play their match at home, which is really sad. I think it's always disappointing when a team has to forfeit home advantage. And I also think Central African Republic playing in Bangui are a much more formidable side than one that has to play outside the country. In the previous World Cup qualifiers, they had to play one of the home matches against South Africa in Cameroon and another one against Ethiopia in Congo-Brazzaville. No news yet, but I think, Sunny, it's inevitable that they won't play at home. Nevertheless, I think the Central African Republic can get the better of Guinea-Bissau, and that would pit them against Burundi or Botswana, and I think there's a good chance that the Central African Republic can win that one as well, notwithstanding the fact that they will have to play their home matches on foreign soil. Next up, Sunny, we've got Swaziland or Sierra Leone against Gambia or Seychelles. I think it'll be between Sierra Leone and Gambia, and I'm going for Leone Stars. Sao Tome or Benin against Malawi or Chad. This one is difficult to call. My initial thoughts are it will be Benin or Malawi. That one is really tight. I know you're going to demand a prediction, Sonny. I'll go with Malawi, but that's a very tentative tip. And then another really big one, Tanzania or Zimbabwe against Mozambique or South Sudan. Now, South Sudan, they'll be making their debut in the Cup of Nations, but I fear they're not going to be strong enough to upset Mozambique. And then Tanzania or Zimbabwe, two ambitious sides, sides that have been higher ranked in previous tournaments. Jeepers, this one is tough to call. I'll go with Zimbabwe to beat Tanzania and also to beat Mozambique. But I fear, Sonny, I'm not going to get 7 out of 7 with my predictions. If I get about 5 right, I think I'll have done well. Now, those second round matches, they're on the weekends of July 18 to 20, with the return matches on August 1 to 3. And the winners, Sonny, of those 7 second round matches in the knockout phase, they go through to the group phase.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
In National Basketball Association playoff action Monday night, the two-time defending champion Miami Heat cruised into the second round with a 109-98 victory over the host Charlotte Bobcats. Miami swept the best of 7 game series 4-0. Superstar LeBron James once again led the Heat with a game-high 31 points and 9 assists. LeBron gave his teammates a scare in the third quarter when he collided with Charlotte's Bismack Biyombo, the pride of Lubumbashi in the Democratic Republic of Congo. LeBron remained on the floor for more than a minute with a thigh injury, but he eventually got up and stayed in the game. In other NBA playoff results, in a Texas showdown, the San Antonio Spurs defeated the host Dallas Mavericks 93-89. This best of 7 series is now tied at 2 games each. In another game, the Atlanta Hawks beat the host Indiana Pacers 107-97. The Hawks now lead this series 3-2. Finally, the sunny side of sports remembers Hall of Fame basketball coach Jack Ramsey, who died of cancer Monday at age 89. Nicknamed Dr. Jack, Ramsey led the Portland Trailblazers to the NBA title in 1977. Rest in peace, Dr. Jack Ramsey. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, the World Bank says Africa has experienced decades of economic growth, but 11 million youth are unemployed. And next, a sophisticated cardiac center in Cameroon. But first, some music. Here is Miss Jojo of Rwanda with Sinakwi Bagui.
Kutandukana nari ziko gwaribwo bona bangiye kubaho boni ryavira nkabona niryavitara byaroroshye kugusezera numvaga ko nabambonye paradizo nizeraga aho mu bisubizo numvaga ko natinze mu kanya gato I'm
twapfu yari je wabikoze ariko sinakwibagiwe zarinda mfa zarinda mfa bikimbabaza natekerezaga kwayo magana azampa amahoro maze nkagamarara none ubu amarira yo namaganya ibyo mbura n'uwambiganira konyura hase batwira posarayise nazanane ibyo biti by'ubutesi ku isi ndimo ari hanjye mu mibare
Rwanda's Miss Jojo with Sinakwi Bagwi.
Well, the World Bank says Africa has experienced one of its best decades of growth since the 1960s. Some Africans say that economic progress will not create enough jobs for 11 million youth entering the job market every year. Miriamma Diallo looks at education in Africa, one area that development experts say needs to be re-evaluated and greatly improved.
The World Bank says that more than 70% of African children complete primary school, up from about 50% in 1990. But the quality of that education is in question. A recent World Bank report notes that lack of a solid foundation in reading and mathematics makes it harder for young workers to get more productive jobs. Dion Filmer is co-author of the report.
For a group of southern and eastern African countries, this regionally benchmarked exercise identified that 60% of sixth graders, after 6 years of schooling, could not reach the level what they define as beginning numeracy. That means that these kids can recognize numbers, but they really don't know what to do with them.
The report also shows that in a number of countries, including Uganda and Mali, more than 70% of students in grade 2 and 3 could not read a single word of a simple paragraph. Serigne Baye Thiam, the Senegalese education minister, recently attended the World Bank IMF spring meetings in Washington. He points out that another important problem is the mismatch between the education system and the labor market.
On nous demande de former des gens pour des métiers qui n'existent pas encore.
We are asked to educate people for future jobs that don't exist yet, to teach them how to solve problems that haven't occurred, and using teaching methods that have not been developed yet. That's why I believe in the education sector, we should create departments that would look into what tomorrow's professions will be like, so we can train people to be ready for that.
Cham also says schools need to emphasize more science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the so-called STEM fields.
L'évaluation de notre système éducatif nous amène à constater qu'il n'y a que 20% des bacheliers qui ont des baccalauréats scientifiques. Les 80% sont dans des filières littéraires ou générales. L'objectif que nous avons dans le programme sectoriel pour l'éducation qui couvre la période 2013-2025.
Development experts say improving education will help Africa's youth be more competitive at home and in the global market. But for educated workers to get jobs, Africa's leaders must create a better business environment with access to land, capital, infrastructure, and technology. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
For most people in Cameroon, high-quality heart care is often expensive or not even available. The exception is a sophisticated cardiac center located in the northwest of the country. But Yaoundé-based reporter Eugene Forangwa says the hospital is so remote that many cannot take full advantage of its services.
13-year-old Asanam Foot almost died on her way to hospital. Her heart was failing and the journey involved riding through bumpy roads. The St. Elizabeth Cardiac Center, located on the remote plateaus of northwestern Cameroon, was the best hospital for the procedure she needed. The trip was unavoidable. Each year, thousands of patients like Foot make the uncomfortable ride to the center for the cutting-edge care. Last year, doctors performed more than 100 open-heart surgeries. The center has begun implanting pacemakers and plans to introduce other procedures in the coming years. It's the only such facility in Cameroon and perhaps in all of Central Africa. St. Elizabeth is well equipped and meets the best international standards. Its two theaters and 12-bed intensive care unit are fitted with interlacing tubes, hanging lamps, monitors, and all sorts of bleeping gadgets. Its staff is well trained and come from all corners of the world. Sister Jethro Nkenglefak, the nun in charge of the center, says St. Elizabeth's is unique.
But the other theaters were adapted. They were not viewed as cardiac theaters. We were constructed solely to take care of cardiac patients whose care is very complicated and needs a lot of advanced technology and equipment and consumables. All of Cameroon, there is none. I will say that without fear of any contradiction, there is none that is like us. And the open heart surgeries, there's none that perform pediatrics.
In mid-February 2014, Mfuthu was recovering in Ward 5. Her heart began showing signs of failure when she was just 9. It would beat violently from time to time. When she was 12, she could not walk for 5 minutes without stopping to pant. She was sent away from school because she would collapse 2 to 3 times a week, and the principal feared she would die on campus. But today, there's good news for heart patients. Care at a more affordable cost. The St. Elizabeth Cardiac Center charges only $3,000 for procedures, compared to $80,000 in places like the United States and Europe. But access to its services is limited. To reach the hospital, just on the other side of the hill, Mfuthu had to travel along one of the country's worst roads. Going to the cardiac center is not an easy task even for someone with a healthy heart. Usually there is only one truly drivable road that links it to the rest of the country through the regional capital, Bamenda. But earlier this year, sections of the Bamenda-Kumbu Highway were under repair, making the drive slightly smoother than before. All other roads that lead to the center are, in the best of times, winding rugged paths through hills and valleys. When it's dry, the journey can last an entire day. When it's wet, it's common for travelers to be stuck in knee-deep mud, meaning 2 to 3 days to travel between 50 to 100 kilometers. And in the absence of adequate transportation, patients travel by overloaded minibuses and even motorcycles. Sister Jethro says the remote location was chosen for several reasons. It's close to an existing hospital that could donate staff services inland. The climate, with temperatures dropping to 4 degrees Celsius, is well suited for cardiac care. Doctor says wounds heal faster in lower temperatures. But the most important reason appears to have been the desire to reach to poor rural patients.
The tertiary sisters, who are the brain behind all of this, are a religious congregation with one of their main objectives being to attend to the poor and underprivileged. We find us in the most remote parts of the world where people really need us, or where nobody goes to.
Yet, some make the difficult journey. Sometimes rich people come by helicopter. Others stay home, hoping that community outreach workers will come to them with medication. Those who live in the big cities can take advantage of mobile clinics run by the St. Elizabeth Cardiac Center. The program involves transferring the entire outpatient department to a partner hospital, where cardiologists, pharmacists, nurses are brought in to consult people on the spot. Critics blame the poor access to the hospital on a mixture of politics and bad policies. The Northwest, the region where the center is located, is considered an opposition stronghold, and inhabitants think they are being punished with bad roads. But it's also clear that the country's health policy does not take into account the problem of accessibility. Roads are the business of the Ministry of Works, and hospitals are overseen by the Ministry of Public Health. Both have different priorities. Patients are the ones who suffer from the failure to coordinate policies. The ill must decide whether the slow and torturous trip is worth it. many do not make it to the hospital alive. For VOA News, I'm Eugene Fongwa in Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The political crisis in South Sudan, which has already resulted in the deaths of thousands of people and displacement of 1 million more, took an even more serious turn with the targeting of civilians by armed individuals in recent attacks in the towns of Bentiu and Bor. Forces opposed to the government of President Salva Kiir on April 15th and 16th overran Bentiu, the capital of Unity State, and killed an estimated 200 or more, including women and children, while injuring at least 400 others. Many of the killings are reported to have been motivated solely by the individual's ethnic origin. While seeking shelter in a local hospital, mosque, and church, the victims were separated and killed according to their ethnic origin, according to the United Nations mission in South Sudan. The violence was further incited by a local FM radio station broadcast declaring that certain ethnic groups should not stay in Bentiu and even calling on men from one community to commit sexual violence against women from another. Following the violence in Bentiu, an armed mob attacked as a reprisal the UN compound in Bor, the capital of Jonglei State, and killed dozens of internally displaced civilians who had sheltered there, hoping to escape the violence. The United States strongly condemns the attacks in both Bentiu and Bor. We also call again on both the government of South Sudan and the armed opposition forces to end this cycle of violence and restore law and order. Both sides must fully respect UNMISS's mission to protect civilians. Both armed groups must also respect the human rights of the civilian population. The deliberate targeting of civilians or the United Nations is unacceptable, and those responsible for such acts must be held accountable. An African Union commission has been set up to investigate human rights abuses committed during the four-month-old conflict and will travel to South Sudan and begin its work soon. Meanwhile, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development's monitoring and verification mechanism is already investigating the Bentiu and Bor attacks and will be submitting their reports to the IGAD Special Envoy shortly. We call on the government and opposition forces to cooperate with the investigations, and we look forward to its report.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.